This is the last formal session of the LSE Law, Law Technology and Society program for this academic year. We'll be picking up again at the start of next academic year. And we're ending on a high note. Some of you will know that we've benefited from earlier lectures from Professor Jeremias Adams-Prassel of Oxford University, who talked about the AI Act, the Artificial Intelligence Act, a regulation of the European Union, proposed regulation, in the context of employment and artificial intelligence in the workplace. And he made some very interesting points about the legal basis for the Artificial Intelligence Act. Last night, we were very glad to have Dr. Emmanuel Kahenwe, I'll introduce in a moment, who talked about foundation data and problems with sets, data sets that are used in searches. And I'm sorry, Manny, if I've glossed over that. And tonight we're going to hear about the role of standards in the context of the Artificial Intelligence Act. And as Dr. Sebastian Hallensleben explained to me before, how the role of standards will actually make the Artificial Intelligence Act work. Some of that is clearly about future working, and what I'm hoping we're going to hear is some of the thinking that went into the approach to this legislation. The legislation itself probably needs not much introduction. It is the biggest news in formal regulation of artificial intelligence globally. That is because it is comprehensive. It has been worked on for several years at various levels within the European Union. And it purports it's designed to do two things. One is to regulate artificial intelligence, building trust and confidence in so doing. But at the same time, it looks to creating a large, vibrant single market within the European Union for the deployment of artificial intelligence. And so it is the only major piece of regulation anywhere in the world, compounded by the fact that, of course, anything that the European Union produces as a regulation will be implemented, will apply directly within the whole block of the European Union, and in some cases, the European Economic Area as well, to be seen. And some of you will know as well that the Artificial Intelligence Act has an extraterritorial effect. So rather like GDPR, although one doesn't want to push the comparisons too far, those third country organizations within the supply chain of artificial intelligence who wish to make available artificial intelligence in the European Union market will have to comply with a serious set of rules. So in effect, that extends the territoriality of the proposed regulation to those organizations outside. And then of course there is the Brussels effect, and overall, what the European Union expects is that the European Union itself will become the central market for artificial intelligence in the coming years. As I understand it, the proposed Artificial Intelligence Act is still going through a series of discussions. There is still, I think, quite intensive lobbying going on among various interest groups to promote various ideas. There are concerns about too many exemptions in the areas of national security and criminal law enforcement and so on. We're going to hear now from our two distinguished guests. Firstly, Dr. Sebastian Hallensleben, who is head of digitalization and AI at VDE. Sorry, in order of speaking,
yes.
Dr. Emmanuel Kahenwe, who is chief executive officer of VDE UK and Ireland. So as you're going first, Manny, if I may call you that, please do explain what VDE does. What I've learned is that it's a very powerful organization, very influential in Europe, but it's perhaps less well known in the UK. And I know that part of your role is to make us better educated about VDE. You were recently awarded two doctorates, one from the University of Edinburgh, another from the Heriot Watt University, both in artificial intelligence, robotics, and autonomous systems, although I imagine each is somewhat differently flavored. And you are also currently within Digital Sovereignty Working Group of CEN, CEN, and CENELEC. Our next speaker will be Dr. Sebastian Hallersleben, who is Head of Digitalization and AI at VDE. I do urge you to go on to LinkedIn to get the full stories behind Emmanuel and Sebastian. A short summary of Dr. Hallersleben's career so far. He's also chaired Joint Technical Committee 21 Artificial Intelligence at CEN, CEN, and CENELEC. He's on the European Commission Stand ICT Expert Advisory Group and chair of the TWG Trusted Information Grouping. He is co-chair of OECD One AI Classification Risk Assessment, and so his roles continue. He has a very distinguished academic career, having amongst others, a doctorate from University of Sussex in physics, having attended the University of Würzburg, and having a first degree from University of Tübingen. So if I may now hand over to Emmanuel and to Sebastian.
I'm going to stand next to the microphone or?
You don't do close, it will be better.
All right, so for those who are here yesterday, we got to cover some gross overview of kind of like what that AI ecosystem looks like from a practitioner's point of view, what's involved in actually deploying our AI project into the real world. And there were many questions afterwards, both do with the issues around that were obvious from this process, but also, I guess, how to rein this in, as in how do we actually formalize this into something that we can trust and use in everyday life. And thus, this leads to this talk that we're having today, which is that process, in a sense. And in order to, I guess, my job today, I had my moment of fame yesterday, is to kind of sit around and get people in thinking, first of all, what is sterilization? How does it relate to regulation? And what does that mean for the AI Act? To start with that is Pascal case, a washing machine. Everyone has one. I assume most people trust them. Since this is a small group here in person, I'm going to be quoting people, I guess, quoting an audience. In a sense that, first question, when you buy a washing machine, what do you look for? What do you look for in a washing machine when you buy one?
Efficiency.
Efficiency,
yeah,
that's exactly.
Efficiency in what sense?
Energy efficiency.
Okay, there's energy efficiency, okay. Any other type of efficiency?
Performance.
Yes, there's performance efficiency, and that's everything from how long it takes to, wash your clothes and how good a job it does. Interestingly, when most people think about this washing machine, they don't think about the number of, I guess, the regulations and standards that surround such a piece of equipment that's inside your house. You trust that you're going to buy it, it's not going to burn down your house. You've got something that's spinning at a very high RPM. You know, it's like almost like having a small little jet engine in your house, and everyone has one, and they trust that it works correctly. It's got thousands of components in it, not necessarily from the same manufacturer. And we can still trust that it operates as expected. At least if you buy one, a washing machine, and it breaks the next day, like something is wrong, because that is unexpected behavior. And so I guess I use this example here because it's a standard piece of equipment that I assume everyone uses every day. And AI is going to be like that. And in this sense, I can kind of relate where we want to end up from where we are right now. So I was recently at the VD offices in Offenbach, where we actually went to the testing institutes to test such machines. Whenever you buy one, they have all been tested at an institute such as ours, which I believe is one of the largest in the world. And apart from, when you think about things like performance and energy efficiency, and you expect it to, and you get the nice little ratings on the side in a readable form, what backs that is, for example, one of the tests that I've done for this machine is you have a standard piece of dirty towel. Like there's a standardized dirty towel with types of dirt on it. This is a business for an entire company. And we get that piece of dirty towel and we put it in the washing machine in a particular orientation, delivered from some manufacturer. Like every washing machine has to go through this process. And we put it through a cycle for a set amount of time. We keep pretty much everything the same, as in we control for the type of water, because water changes depending on which region of the world you're in. So there's actually a machine that simulates the water compositions from different parts of the world, so that you make sure that the machine can work, the washing machine can actually work to all the environments it's deployed in. And then after the cycle is done, after a pre-allocated amount of time, you take that towel out and you put it under another machine that actually grades how well it's done this job of washing. This is your performance test, right? And so when you, at the end, when a company like BDE certifies it for a certain level of performance, this is the minimum criteria. I guess at the end of what the minimum criteria that you assume that there's a minimum criteria of testing and quality control that has gone into this process. Not to mention that the individual pieces in here are already tested. They're already certified for operating under particular loads of electrical loads. And the interesting thing is that even with all the individual components tested and certified, the whole still has to be tested and certified within what we assume is going to be the operational domain, as I call it, the environment in which it's going to operate. And so one of the interesting things that I guess was raised up by one of the testing engineers was that when liquid detergent came along, is that the fact that you could, most people put this on top of the washing machine and it spills, required the testing spec to change to accommodate for that. So now that's also something that's included in the test. It's a bit reactionary in the sense that we didn't expect this to begin with, but this happened enough times that testing criteria and the standards around this evolved to match the real world. So that's your washing machine. Safety, we check for that. Reliability, we check for that. We have guarantees on that, we have metrics on that. And in the end, this alludes to the main reason you trust your washing machine to do the job it does. And I guess one of the things I forgot to bring up is that even how loud your machine is tested. We put it into one of these soundproof rooms with microphones all around, because your machine's going to be on for several hours a day, you know, several times a week. So we need to also test for that, because that's also can be categorized probably as a health or a safety issue. All right. And again, hitting on the point that, which is something that you'll keep on seeing in the AI world, is that we tested one bit, so it works. And, you know, but even in this case of a machine where we can say we understand all the components completely in some way, we can build nice models of it and how it should operate, we still test the whole machine even after putting guarantees on the individual components. And that's why, if you scale this up to more complicated systems, this is why you trust the plane you fly in. All right, so what are the goals for standardization? The first thing is to make sure we have a common language. Legislation tries to do the same thing, but standardization kind of formalizes it as we sit there and debate on the terminology that everyone's going to be speaking, since at the end, when you create a standard and people have to test that standard, and to achieve that standard, it has to be the same no matter where in the world you are. So a common language is defined. The other thing that standards allow for is they actually help with traction and market adoption. Once a standard is created, people at least can go and see what criteria piece of equipment or software that meets that standard as is supposed to meet. And in general, if you have a product that's certified as meeting a standard, it's a little bit more trustworthy than one that's not. In most cases, much more trustworthy than the one that's not, especially in the software case. And that will help in, if you go to a consumer, even though you might pretend that they do not notice these things, I think between if you're comparing products, it does matter. You have symbols of trust. And those trust symbols, and the reason, again, the reason why you gain traction as a company or any organization is that you have this assurance of quality and safety, and trust that the product you have will operate as expected. The other thing, the other goal of standardization is conformity and support of regulations and policy. There's sometimes the standards preempt the regulations, sometimes the regulations, you know, start the process for standardization, but the two come hand in hand. And also they help agree on what is good practice, especially in the case where standards start to preempt legislation. So the big thing that I guess you're gonna get from Sebastian's talk now is what should this look like for AI? We'd hope that you can trust your AI algorithm as much as you can trust your washing machine. I'll leave it on that note, Sebastian.
I should change a little bit the slides. So for those of you at home, there'll be a slight section where we hand over the different set of slides here.
Actually, while you do that, I can do a little interlude on what those letters really actually mean at the bottom. So as we heard in the introduction, it's a fairly large organization. It exists in many different countries, but it's not very well known. It's actually an old organization, 130 years old, and it started at a time when electricity was the new, the dangerous, but also the exciting and promising technology. And at the time, there were lots of accidents. There was a lot of jostling in the market with different companies trying to push their ways of implementing electricity, DC versus AC, different voltage levels. Plugs and sockets didn't fit together. They were from different manufacturers. And there was a real danger that the adoption of electricity, the broad rollout of electricity wouldn't happen for commercial reasons, but also because society at some point says, well, now let's go back to those old gas lights. They're a bit dirty, but they're more reliable, and it's the devil, you know. And in this context, a bunch of electrical engineers came together in Berlin, led by Werner von Siemens, and they created the EEM to develop the initial set of standards for electrical safety and also for interoperability of electrical components. And that organization exists to this day, creating standards, but also testing against standards, as Manny explained, ranging from washing machines all the way to cables, to electrical components, but also to software items with cybersecurity issues, testing against health standards, and so on. Okay, so thanks again for the introduction, and also for the jump off point towards how does this all work for AI, and what's the role of the AI Act in that? I've put a long list of affiliations onto this first slide, not to show off, but to demonstrate how many different moving parts there are at the European level, at the supranational level, that make AI regulation, standardization, governance happen. And I also expanded a little bit on the title of the seminar. I think it was advertised as Drafting the EU AI Act. I'm actually not going to talk that much about the drafting of the AI Act itself, because that has been presented by European Commission officials in quite a few events already, but more around the context that is needed for the AI Act to function, or for a complex piece of regulation like the AI Act to function. So let's wind back a number of years. What were the initial thoughts, processes that led to the AI Act? It's been around for a while, that statement, well, Europe has to take a third way for AI. Not quite the Chinese way, not AI for full control of everything in the country, and also not quite the US way, AI driven mainly by commercial motives, but something that is sort of European. And there were two aspects to it. First of all, protecting the interests of Europe with respect to rights, values, and principles, and also to protect European citizens and promote European industry. And these two parts of the discussion have been reflected almost from the start in all the actions that the European Commission took to start to prepare the drafting process. Most notably in the high-level expert group that worked 2017, 2018, and came up with a number of pretty good, very readable reports that actually split into those parts. Okay, so what does AI need to do to protect European fundamental values? And what does AI need to do to protect the interests of European industry and also to promote innovation at the European level? So the question is, what are actually the specificities? What is special around the European situation and hence about the European approach to AI? And I'd like to highlight four aspects, some obvious, some maybe a little bit more surprising. So a fairly obvious one is ethics and trustworthiness of AI. Everyone in the world agrees around transparency, fairness, privacy being important, but very few people understand how to operationalize and how to enforce things like transparency and measure and privacy. How do you even measure transparency? And hence, how can you enforce it? And that desire, not just to have nice words on a company website saying, oh, our AI is transparent and it protects privacy, but rather having metrics to measure it and to enforce certain standards on it, that is a European specificity. The next item I'm calling data efficiency. Companies both in China and in the US are spoiled for data because they've been accustomed to just milking anything that happens online and anything that people do online for vast amounts of data. And therefore, it's easy for them to train AI with vast amounts of data. In Europe, we don't do that. And we're sort of proud that we're not collecting every available bit of data. But it also means that we need to look at a broader spectrum of AI methods that work without needing such vast amounts of data. And that not only helps in consumer-focused applications of AI, it also helps in certain industrial applications. So imagine you want to train an AI system to spot the early warning signs of a chemical factory blowing up. you can't really let 1,000 factories blow up to collect enough data to train your AI system to spot the early warning signs. You need a different way. You need to be more creative. And so that, if you like, artificial dearth of data in Europe is actually a promoter of innovation as far as AI is concerned. Next, obviously, data protection, but also data jurisdiction. We do have a jurisdictional issue with data already and with AI as well. I'm not going to dive into that because that's been discussed a lot. But also, and this again refers back to the availability of data, we don't have in Europe the huge corporations that have everything under one roof, collecting the data, analyzing it, creating algorithms, training algorithms, having the applications to roll out AI applications. A company like Facebook or Microsoft or Google has it all under one roof. We do not have such huge corporations in Europe. We might have one company that has the data, another company that can analyze it, a third company that can train an algorithm, and so on. And we don't want to merge everything together in Europe to create that behemoth company. So if those puzzle pieces come from different directions, they need to fit together. So we need to work a lot harder on the right interfaces and the right standards to make sure that those puzzle pieces and those data sets can come together. So, as I said at the beginning, I'm not going to rehash the whole AI Act. I'm not a legal specialist. And also this has been presented quite a few times before. Just as a reminder, I'd like to highlight two of the key principles that the European Commission has chosen to follow drafting the Act. One of them is that they very wisely didn't attempt to regulate the technology, which is wise because it's not even possible to clearly define what AI is, but they chose to regulate the application of the technology. And secondly, they chose to implement a risk-based approach, so not to have the same type of regulation for all applications of AI, but graded by risk. And that picture is from an EU presentation on this. But if you do look into the AI Act, it doesn't go into that much more detail. It does, yes, it sort of explains in a few sentences what each of those risk levels do, but that's not nearly enough for practical purposes. So it outlines the overall policy objectives, but all the operationalization is left to other parties. So, for example, we might want or need details on more detailed, more fine-grained rules of which application fits into which risk categories under which circumstances. We might need some rules and input on how this risk pyramid fits together with existing risk management frameworks, for example, in the health and safety world or in medical devices, and where risk management and risk mitigation have a long tradition, and there's a lot that has been written and standardized around it. We'll also need procedures and responsibilities for conformity assessment. Again, the AI Act has a few sentences on those, but it's not particularly detailed at all. And we also need some more practical details. So maybe tools to implement those mapping rules, tools for testing. We might also need collections of best practice guidance on how to achieve maybe an informed AI, and also how to structure an organization so that development processes result in good AI, whatever good is in a given context. So the question is, who does this? Who picks up after the lawmakers finish and have gone home, so to speak? The answer's got multiple parts. So I'd like to start with the more practical details that need to be filled in. And there's actually a mix of actors involved here. There's private sector companies, there's multinational organizations, there's NGOs, that can all work very freely and without any obvious coordination on such issues. A few examples here. OECD is one, IEEE is a very well-known one and very active and has been active in AI ethics and trustworthiness for a number of years. Big Data Value Association, Gaia X, they don't call themselves a standardization organization, but they create standard IT architecture definitions, and it's everything, it is standardization except in name. And also, interesting for you, I'm wondering whether anyone here has been looking into that already, the Council of Europe, so not to be confused with the European Council, but Council of Europe with 47 members, maybe 46 if they kick out Russia, has an AI working group that is very heavy on legal side, and also very thorough in its analysis, and it's very well worth a read. Given that there are so many countries and such a diverse range of countries involved there, it's the output there is very, very impressive. So I can only recommend that. Okay, so that's just some of the universe of companies that work on detailing the AI Act. As we go to the more formal, more kind of regulation-like details that need to be filled in, we're getting to a very specific set of organizations, the European standardization organizations. Three organizations, I'll show them on the next slide. And they have a special relationship with the European Union, and they, and only they, are allowed to create so-called harmonized standards. The harmonized standard is a standard that is published alongside the regulation. So it almost is like regulation, but it is produced in a completely different way, and I'll get to that a little bit later. So I said three organizations. You see them in the middle tier, European organizations that are allowed to produce European standards, that CEN, CENELEC, and ETSI. And they are connected to the European Union through the so-called new legislative framework. This is actually a lie. This goes back to the 1980s. It's still called the new legislative framework. And I'll get into a few of the details in a moment. And you see three columns there. So you have a kind of general standardization topics. We have electrotechnical topics, and we have telecommunications topics. There are historical reasons for having those three columns, but they go all the way to the international level as well. You'll be familiar with ISO, IEC, and ITU, and they are the international correspondent organizations to CEN, CENELEC, and ETSI. And at the national level, you have those organizations as well. In Germany, we have DIN and DKE, which is the standardization part of VDE. And in the UK, you've got BSI that covers the whole national level. In France, it's AFNOR. And depending on the country, you might have one, two, or three organizations covering the national side. So the AI committees are typically not associated with one of the three columns. And that's because it's not obvious where they fit. Is AI an electrotechnical issue? Or is it an IT issue? Or is it a safety issue or risk management issue? It has a little bit of both. And to stop wrangling between the organizations on who gets the AI group, because it's all new and sexy and attracts lots of experts and lots of publicity, most of the organizations decided to form joint committees. And so you have the Joint Committee 1, Subcommittee 42 at the international level, formed by ISO and IEC. And at the European level, it's the JTC 21, which I'm chairing. And we also have a very tight integration with Etsy. Okay, so new necessity framework, as I said, it goes back to the 80s. And in its current incarnations, if you browse through the year numbers that are in the text here, it's about 10, 15 years old. So it's this is actually a slide that I lifted from a presentation by the European Commission, by Senator Stelzel, who's their AI coordinator. So this is top up to date and from the source. But I'm also not going to go too deep into it. But what you can see is that this framework consists of a number of individual pieces of regulation that together form the special relationship between the European Union and the European Standardization Organizations. And what does it contain? First of all, it contains the process under which the European Commission formulates essential requirements to say, yep, this is really, really important for us. This is what standards need to describe to underpin the AI Act. It contains the processes for creating harmonized standards. It contains the division of responsibilities. So what are the roles of manufacturers, with importers, distributors, and also it contains conformity assessment procedures. And most importantly, not all, it contains a presumption of conformity. So if the manufacturer of an AI product can show that their product follows the applicable harmonized standards, there's a presumption of conformity to the regulation. And there is also a presumption of not being liable if something goes wrong. So if this doesn't just apply to AI, it applies to the washing machine and to other products as well. If a manufacturer doesn't follow the standards, in many cases they can do that because standards are still voluntary. But if the washing machine behaves erratically, if it burns down the house, the manufacturer has to prove that it was not the washing machine's fault. Whereas if the manufacturer does follow all the applicable standards for washing machines and the house burns down, then the owner of the house or the insurance company has to prove that the washing machine was at fault. So that's a very, very powerful incentive to conform to standards. Okay, so I'd like to drill a little bit deeper into what's actually happening inside such a standardization group. And since I'm chairing JTC 21, I pick on it as an example, but the processes are quite similar in other similar groups as well. So first of all, the standardization committee has got a scope. And that scope is a statement that is being fought over tooth and nail in and around the kickoff session of such a committee. So it reads quite harmless, but it's a result of a lot of wrangling between different interests, which I'll mention a little bit later. But so it says, create standardization deliverables for AI, so those could be standards or technical reports, and its use of related data. It says, consider the adoption of international standards relevant to Europe. This is very, very carefully crafted as a statement. There is no point in reinventing the wheel at the European level. If a standard for AI, for a certain aspect of AI, already exists or is being developed at the international level, and it fits the European needs, fine, great. European committee might kind of stick a European number on it, might even kind of elevate it to the status of a harmonized standard, and be done with it and say, yeah, fine, an afternoon's work, and we'll have a whole new standard for Europe, fine. In other cases, international standards might not exist at all, or they might exist, but not quite fit European needs or the European situation, in which case they are being modified to serve European needs. And finally, final bubble there is really reaffirmation that just like regulation, standardization of AI is supposed to address European market and societal needs and underpin European legislation, policies, principles, and values. And even that last sentence was to our discussion at the kickoff meeting. Should values be in there? We're standardizers, what are we talking about? Values? Is it going too far? So long discussions in those. You can see from the number of countries that are participating just how seriously people take AI. So it's very unusual for a standardization committee at the European level to have that many participants from that many countries. Normally it might be half a dozen countries or so. Typically those that are leading from an engineering perspective in a given technology that's been standardized. Also, JTC 21 has an unusually large number of interfaces to the outside world. Of course, the standardization committee related activities happening in other groups in Europe and internationally, but also a very strong interface to the European Commission. In a typical meeting, we might have 100 people from the standardization world, but also easily 10 people from the European Commission, from the various directorates, DG Just, DG Connect, DG Grow, the Joint Research Center, DG Santé. And it just underlines how seriously the European Commission takes the role of standardization in supporting their AI Act. There's also a slightly mysterious term on here, Annex III organizations, which sounds a little bit like a secret society. This is actually the hallmark of standardization, that it's not just companies coming together and agreeing on technical standards. Standardization is supposed to bring together all relevant stakeholders, whatever relevant means in a given situation. So it could be consumer organizations, it could be small businesses, it could be trade unions, it could be organizations promoting environmental sustainability. And Annex III actually lists a handful of organizations in Europe, including, for example, ANEC for consumer issues, that have a sort of automatic role or kind of a special role within standardization. But the secretary and the chair of the standardization committee has a duty to reach out as far as possible. If we think as a management team that, I don't know, Japanese whaling organizations are relevant for a given standard, we have to reach out to them and at least ask them, do you want to come in and contribute? Okay, so I'm now going to build a picture that looks extremely messy at the end, but I'm going to build it step by step, and hopefully it'll become clear, and it'll become an insight for you into, well, how does such a group actually decide what to do? Because you've got a bunch of 100 people in the room from 20 countries, from maybe 40, 50, 60 different organizations, some small, some large, some very kind of profit-driven industrial, some more on an NGO perspective. How do you actually get those 100 people to decide on what to standardize in the first place? And how do you do it in a way that it makes the European Union happy and supports the AI Act as well? So there's actually, first of all, a route mapping process. SAG stands for Strategic Advisory Group, sort of the chair advisory group of JTC21. And it is a top-down review of European standardization needs. So it looks at previous work in the standardization world, the draft of the AI Act, any standardization requests issued by the European Union, and so on. And it also does a top-down review. What do we already have that might satisfy those standardization needs at the international level, at IEEE, Europe, elsewhere? And presumably there's a gap in that top-down analysis, and that gives an initial hint on potential activities that JTC 21 should consider. this is not a one-off process, but something that repeats again and again over time. So that's a top-down approach. But there's also a bottom-up approach. So you've got all the national committees in individual countries looking at, well, what do they think needs to be standardized for AI? You've got people coming together in ad hoc groups to consider certain standardization topics. And typically, each of those is very much focused on one particular need. So for example, let's say green AI. So again, they did, oh, there's a need, what existing work do we have? And if there's a gap, that might be another potential JTC21 activity. And again, this is something that's more or less an ongoing process. So somehow these potential activities need to be merged or considered together to form so-called new work item proposals. So someone, again, it's quite tightly regulated, who's got that right, proposes a new work item, there's a special form for that, and it's supposed to take into account both relevant pieces from the bottom-up work and the top-down work. Goes to a ballot, 8 to 12 week ballot amongst all the national bodies, and then the work item can start as technical report, technical specification, or a harmonized standard. Here it stands for harmonized standard. And again, that repeats over time, kicking off more and more items. Okay, and to stop it being so completely abstract and theoretical, this is the list of current bottom-up activities that are being worked on in JTC 21. I'd like to briefly walk through them to just give you a flavor of what is actually happening there. So augmented goal specification refers to a very thorny issue. People say you can't express ethics as a mathematical formula. And most people agree, yes, yeah, that would be horrible if we had a formula for ethics. No, let's not go there. But if you train an AI system and you want to tell the AI system, well, this is the way, the ideal way to behave, and the idea, you need to express that ideal behavior in a mathematical way, otherwise you can't do the training. But what if that ideal behavior contains certain ethical issues as well? All of a sudden, you have to express your ethical goals, objectives, in a mathematical way. And this ad hoc group on the augmented goals specification looks at ways to resolve that kind of conflict. Next one is on AI conformity assessment. So this is around defining ways how an AI system or an AI application should be tested. Green and sustainable AI, I already mentioned, a very big issue, also with questions around, well, how do you take into account the huge energy effort during training AI as opposed to during using it AI, how do you take into account whether it was dirty or clean energy, and so on. Speech recognition is a special European concern because we do have many languages. Data governance, and quality is a European concern, and also nudging. So this has to do with how far can AI go in influencing, subtly influencing the behavior of people. The value judgment on this obviously comes from regulators. That's not the role of standardization. But how do you even describe what nudging is? And how do you define what's happening there? That is something that needs to happen on the standard side. Ethics and trustworthiness, I'll get to in a moment, and also risk catalogs and risk management. So looking at ethics and trustworthiness, since it's been discussed so much, how do you handle AI ethics for standardization? It doesn't seem particularly intuitive in how to do that. That's one way that doesn't work. And that's to express explicit ethical rules. So, child's more important than an older person, or vice versa, or it's better to have 100 injured rather than one dead, or vice versa. And most of you will be aware of little experiments like the Moral Machine from the by the University of Michigan that has shown quite nicely that there's no consensus and that, that there are huge cultural differences, and that's not something that standardization should even consider, because that's not what you can achieve there. Fine, easy to say, that's not what we do. You could go to the other extreme. You could say, well, let's leave the whole the actual ethical dilemmas out of it, and we only standardize the processes and the structures that are being used to make AI ethics decisions. That's an approach that is, for example, being used for quality. So you're familiar with the ISO 9001. Companies love saying that they're ISO 9001 certified. ISO 9001 doesn't say what quality is. It just says, follow this process, create this documentation, set up these structures, and if you can prove that, you're ISO 9001 certified, and we assume that this leads to quality in your products. That's an approach we could use for AI ethics, and we kind of work around all these kind of messy dilemmas here. It's got two disadvantages. One, it means that hard, sensitive, ethical decisions are taken inside organizations where they're not open to societal discourse. And two, well, if I'm a large company with profit as the top priority, I might just employ another one or two people in the compliance department to produce a bit more documentation. And it's very, very hard to enforce from outside if companies aren't acting in good faith. So it has limitations. But the IEEE P7000 series is very much on in that camp. And it's more like a best practice guide to companies that do like to do the right thing and don't quite know how. So for obvious reasons, I've left a slot in the middle. And this is what I've been working towards in a number of standardization groups, and an approach that is now taking hold, fortunately. And that's sort of a best of both worlds approach. You all know the energy efficiency label, even came up earlier in the context of the washing machines. The energy efficiency label doesn't say, oh, this is acceptable or not acceptable. It also doesn't even say that strongly whether something is good or bad. It's a standardized way of describing characteristics of the machine. So you might end up with an energy class B. And then you, as a consumer, can make a decision, well, take the cheap machine with class B or the more expensive machine with class A. And even as a regulator, you can use cutoffs. So for example, when incandescent bulbs were outlawed in the European Union a number of years ago, they weren't outlawed by saying, oh, can't sell incandescent bulbs anymore. They were outlawed by saying, well, you can't sell any bulbs anymore with an energy efficiency rating worse than E or D, something like that. And incandescent bulbs just about landed on the wrong side of that cutoff. So you had an energy efficiency label already in existence with all the measurement standards and all the metrics around it to put it into practice. The market knew it, consumers knew it, and regulators could just build on it. And more or less with one sentence, well, I'm sure it was a bit more, but in principle it was with one sentence, outlaw incandescent bulbs. So for the ethical aspects of AI systems, we can use a very similar approach, except that we don't just have one scale from A to G, but we have maybe five or six. So you could have one for, well, how transparent is the system, how accountable, what's the privacy protection like, how fair is it, what justice criteria, how reliable is it. You could even, if you like, also have a rating for environmental sustainability. There is no point aggregating further because, for example, transparency and privacy tend to be, to some extent, mutually exclusive. And you don't really want to prejudge which is more appropriate in the given context. And so that's the level of aggregation that you should get to. And so that's a debate for capturing AI ethics through standards and to make it measurable. I'll skip a whole world of questions there. And I'd like to end by highlighting a few of the difficulties and controversies around standardization. First of all, legitimacy. The AI Act itself, the regulation, takes its legitimacy from the democratic processes within the European Union, either directly through the involvement of the European Parliament or indirectly through the national governments. What is it for standards? Standards are so important, and in the case of harmonized standards, almost like regulation, where do they take their legitimacy from? The easy answer is, it's standardization brings together all relevant stakeholders, and it's a consensus-driven process. It really works very, very hard to achieve consensus, even if it takes years. So that's fine, but that is some degree of legitimacy. True. In practice, the issue is, well, who's actually got the time and budget to contribute to such groups? It's not the startup that consists of three people, all of which are doing seven jobs day and night. It's not going to be the little NGO, also consisting of three people doing seven jobs day and night. It tends to be very large organizations, large industrial companies, and other well-equipped organizations. So that consensus is to some extent skewed. And you could ask the question, well, how legitimate is it? Second issue, European sovereignty. If you look at the list of affiliations of participants in JTC 21, Microsoft, it's Huawei, it's IBM, it's Google, there's Amazon. You could ask the question, well, what business do those global companies have in deciding how Europe handles AI? Yes, they say, well, we obviously do business in Europe. We kind of deal with, we affect European consumers, so we should have a say. But you could ask the question whether that is maybe counter to the idea of having European sovereignty. And on top of that, in the case of Huawei, we have the whole debate around standardization as a geopolitical instrument. China has started to, well, it started maybe 10, 15 years ago to be much more active and much more strategic in contributing to standardization committees and to try and influence standardization according to their own national interests. So there's a fault line there as well. And generally, standardization is driven by whoever understands the technology. If you have a country without AI engineers or AI programmers, that country is not going to send people into standardization groups. So in a sense, it might still be affected by AI standards, but it's not going to shape them. So that again is also a bit of an issue. And in fact, the standardization strategy, the overall standardization strategy that the European Commission, that Thierry Breton presented in February, put a lot of focus on European sovereignty in that context. And that leads on to the next quandary, what is Europe? The scope is surprisingly hard to define, and that's harsh for engineers working in standardization groups, because they usually like kicking off their work on a new topic by defining the terminology. So what is machine, what is AI, what is machine learning, what is, and so on. But if they talk about European specificities, they have to define what is Europe. And that's not clear for an AI system. You might have the servers sitting in a data center in Germany that's run by a French company. The training data comes from murky sources in China. The algorithm was developed in Silicon Valley, and the training happened by a company in Norway, say. And so you have 5, 6, 7 jurisdictions that are somehow touching that AI system. How do you actually say this is a European AI system or not a European AI system? And how do you deal with competing jurisdictions of that system? We have the exact same problem already for data, and the failure of the safe harbor approach and the privacy shield approach have highlighted that we simply haven't got on top of that quandary yet with overlapping jurisdictions. And for AI, it's even worse. So that needs a lot of work. And Manny is one of the groups that tries to find ways of attacking that issue. And finally, obstruction and circumvention by monopolists. I mentioned earlier that standardization takes its legitimacy from being consensus driven. So that means someone with a bit of resources and time who doesn't want standards to exist for a given topic has got a lot of scope for putting the brakes on the standardization process to hold it up, to kind of draw it out for forever. And we've seen it, for example, with office standards, office document standards, where Microsoft kind of dragged out the standardization process for many, many, many years. And we see it in AI as well, that there are some market leaders that simply don't believe that a standard is in their interest, and therefore have an incentive, let's put it that way, to obstruct or circumvent the standardization process. And with these open questions, boundaries, maybe also kind of critical notes on standardization, I'd like to conclude my talk. And I think we've still got, hopefully got time for plenty of questions.
We have. Manny and Sebastian, thank you so much for a fascinating talk. It's not often that we have the opportunity to hear from the inside out and from bottom up and top down about how such seminal European legislation is actually influenced and then legislated for. So I'd like those in the room, those at home, if you'd like to, please. Wonderful talk. Andrew, I think you're going to be coordinating any questions on Zoom.
We do. We have a few questions on Zoom. Now, this is set up as a webinar, so I think even if we get rid of the slides, we won't see the people who are on Zoom.
But should I pick up the
you can do. Thank
you. Slides, perhaps.
But I don't think we'll see the people anyway. I think we'll just see the room because it's set up as a webinar. So we've got three questions already put in.
And then I have one too.
But yeah, well, I'm sure. Lots of hands. So shall we start? Actually, I think the easiest thing to do. It must be said also. Right, it's showing me. Wow, that's exciting. We were probably better with the slides, to be honest. The poor people at home are now seeing that.
I think it's okay.
There we go. So there's the Q&A. So in fact, we can now see them up there as well. So the other thing is we will take the questions from the Q&A. So people at home, put questions in the Q&A I'm not going to ask for hands up and for people to unmute themselves and things. Because we had to share this on Zoom, sorry, on Twitter, we had a couple of bots in earlier who were making a real pain about themselves and were being rather rude. So at the risk of not inviting a bot to speak publicly, can I ask people at home to use the Q&A function? And I know it involves typing, but to type out your questions. Martin Husovec has been very busy typing, as we can see. So, I mean, the first question there, as we can see at the top, is from Rahim, who says, and it's, this came in very early on, will this, or how will this affect lawyers in the UK? Would it affect their work only with the European clients who want to expand into the AI industry? So I think this is really about scope and reach of this work. Post-Brexit, do I need to know this? Or any other UK lawyer?
I think the easy answer is yes, because you could ask the same question for a US or for a Canadian lawyer, and the answer would be yes as well. The same way as a American lawyer would have to know about GDPR. It's going to be exactly the same for the AI Act.
If I had no clients, if I had these AI clients who said, I really don't care about the European Union, it's not a market that interests me, is it possible then to avoid the, or is it going to be like GDPR? Do you think this is going to be the global standard, so to speak?
It's hard to say. People were generally surprised just how influential GDPR became, and that it wasn't actually a hindrance on innovation or kind of the competitiveness of European products, but rather almost like a kind of like a seal of quality. And it's fair to assume that the same will happen with the AI Act. We don't know, of course, but I think it will be that way.
Do you want to select a question from the room? I think we'll do a Zoom and room. It's the traditional way.
Well, if I may, as a UK well-qualified legal practitioner post-Brexit, I think it's absolutely essential for UK lawyers to understand in detail the Artificial Intelligence Act as it's finally, when it finally comes into being, and then, of course, it'll come into effect sometime after. And I say that because, firstly, it seems it's possible, but it seems inconceivable that either UK or other third country actors in the artificial intelligence supply chain will not, in some shape or form, have products, services, processes, systems in the market in the European Union. It's very easy to see AI as a, dare I say, washing machine. I had a question on that. I do see, absolutely see where you're coming from. But of course, it is, Maddie made the point, there are many components in a washing machine as there are in AI. And so somewhere in the world, there will be players within supply chains that feed into AI systems and processes that are put into the market in the EU. Now, a client has the choice of going to a range of lawyers within the European Union who are jurisdictionally qualified. I think we find in practice that UK lawyers remain very close to European Union law. Obviously, for in the past tense, because it's still part of UK law, and looking forward because we realise that we are part of a continental Europe. And even if there are jurisdictional differences, our clients are going to need to understand what the requirements are within the EU. So I think it is a measure that everyone who is in legal practice in the area in the UK certainly needs to know about. And I hope that answers the question.
Can I also add to that? As things stand right now, a lot of the standards they're enacted in the EU are automatically inherited.
Right.
So that's another thing to keep in mind. So they will affect UK lawyers, definitely.
Thanks, Mark. And thanks for the talk. This was so detailed, but at the same time, I would say to the point, to give us a sense of the whole process. And I think it was very, very helpful. I have so many questions, but I would just pick perhaps two or three, depending on how generous is the chair with me. The first question that I have is whether there is any regulation or whether there are any rules that establish who should be involved in feeding into these committees. So is this a choice that is taken by the committees, or are there any rules on this? And are there also any requirements as to how identify those that should be involved in this field? Because I think that the committees are really a hybrid figure. Now, applying legal categories, it's a hybrid figure between a public and a private body, it seems to me. So I wonder to what extent then the public interest shapes also the participants to these committees. Then, second question, I was very interested in understanding a bit more on who structures the top-down and bottom-up analysis. So is there any guidance here in this context? Who decides what kind of items should be decided? Because it seems to me that this ultimately also shapes the content of standards. So there is a lot of power in this respect. Final point. I saw that one of the suggested and proposed ways to go about standardization is to use a system similar to that of food labels, right? So the intermediate option that you presented. And I saw that one of the items was justice, how to measure justice. So if you can share some thoughts on this, that would be great. Thank you so much. And I stop here. I could continue, but I'll just stop here. Thank you so much.
Okay, the first two questions are relatively straightforward. The third one is very interesting. not so straightforward. Okay, so on the composition of the committees, the rules of standardization bodies just state all relevant stakeholders. And it's up to
the
management team, so the chair and the secretariat of the committee, to decide or to conclude what relevant means in a given topic. Then there's the Annex 3 set of organizations that sort of gives a hint on who should be involved beyond industry. It's usually not so much an issue of finding the right people or identifying the right organizations. And it's also very rare that, it's unheard of that an organization is actively excluded. Mm-hmm. So if an organization raises their hand and say, right, we want to send an expert into the standardization effort because we think what we do is relevant, they just join. I'm not aware of any examples where someone would say, no, you're not allowed to join. Usually people are quite happy for any helping pair of hands. It's more to do with lack of resources. And I know that there's been some critical commentary by Michael Veal last year, who's analyzed the Draft AI Act, and in the same way also analyzed the standardization around it. He's raised a number, you might have recognized some similarities to my final slide, but I do not share his most serious concerns, which almost, to my mind, almost veer towards kind of a conspiracy myth that there is some secret cabal of people stitching up standardization committees. That's not the case. It's actually a fairly open process, and the limitations are because different organizations have got different resources to throw into it. And that's the fundamental unfairness implicit in it. Mm-hmm. Second question, the processes inside, some of them are very strictly defined in the standardization body regulations, how you set up a new work item, what needs to go to balloting, what can be decided in a plenary meeting, how long before documents have to be distributed, commenting periods, and so on and so forth. But there is also quite a bit of scope for the groups to structure themselves. Ultimately, it's also, it's again kind of dependent on what people put their time into. If standardization work item is approved and no one does the work, then it's still not happening. Third question on justice.
I follow up to that third question. Well, as many would know, because isn't it impossible with certain summit AI systems to even have different types of fairness within one system? Like they will clash. You can't even. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. So there can't be abstract, completely generic definition of fairness or justice. And in fact, in that particular example, there's been a debate whether to call it justice or fairness. There were many pros and cons, which I'm not going to go into. I think fairness is the more common term that is being used. To some extent, it's in the eye of the beholder. To another extent, it depends on the application. But it generally includes criteria such as representativeness. It includes the way that training data is generated, or the kind of broadness of the spectrum of training data. But it can also include certain processes in the organization. So do they even have, for example, did they do some sort of stakeholder engagement to try and figure out what is fair in that specific context? So I've actually involved in a project last year. I can send you some of the results there to try and drill down fairness through a layer of criteria, a layer of indicators, and a layer of observables, more or less a tree structure to try and come up with something that is quite tangible. So I can send that to you.
Question there first, and then we'll come to you.
Thank you. I miss the sort of counsel just to be here. So I did my undergrad degree in statistics and machine learning. So all this concept is very refreshing and also very new to me. So my first question is, which type of AI system are subjected to this type of regulation? I understand that obviously it's a system for like job applications obviously falls under this regulation. But suppose I work for a media agency that deploys recommendation algorithm to audience, which can be subjected to nudging, that's subject to like the AI Act. Also like for ride-hailing applications, the matching algorithm between the riders and the passengers, is that what we define AI as well? And my second question sort of follows the question Julia asked, like how to measure some of the standards. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what is the exact form of reinforcing the standard? Is it like ticking boxes so whether they have this committee to do that, or is like more complicated, you know, like more measures in terms of how to calculate these metrics?
Okay. First question on the scope. The Draft AI Act follows the OECD definition of AI to set the general scope of what it actually refers to. And that is hard because it's very hard to draw a boundary there. But then beyond that, the AI Act doesn't try to define AI, it just defines different applications and the sensitivity of different applications. And it is fairly technology agnostic, and a lot of it could also be used if you wanted to for some really complex software systems that have the same characteristics of AI. For all practical purposes, a black box that you can't really thoroughly test. You don't know what's inside, at least in practical terms. You can't really assess how they behave over the longer term while in use, while in operation. The path that the European Union is taking by regulating the application and not the technology, I think, is a very sensible one and kind of works around that issue. Could you just remind me of the second part of the question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, it's like a follow-up on how to mirror AI. For example, do you take certain boxes, or is it some other system. For example, you don't look at the code, you just look at the end result, like whether the result is like accurate and does not discriminate, or do the organization have to hand out their product design or the code for review?
There was an early attempt by the high-level expert group set up by the European Commission to try and come up with a test catalog that was ridiculously easy to circumvent, let's put it that way. So it said things like, have you considered whether your AI system might discriminate certain vulnerable groups? And I could say, if I take that seriously, yeah, I've considered. I don't care. Of course, it discriminates. I don't care. I can still tick that box. So that was not done in a very good way. More thorough assessments have to go beyond box ticking very clearly, and it's going to be a much, much more involved process, which might be the topic for another seminar.
My question is also related to the rating system for AI. So like, are these metrics going to be mathematical formulas, or are they going to be, principles as such? So,
yeah. I'm happy to send around another piece of work from last year where we tried to build a consensus around that.
Well, where we are now is we are, so just to say, and also for those at home, we're now coming up against our 7:30 deadline. There's still a few questions on Zoom as well. And I do understand that people may need to drop off or people may need to leave. But if the speakers are happy to take a few more minutes, we can address some of these. There are questions from interesting people. So we've got Chris Marsden on Zoom, who I know very well. Chris and I go back years. Chris is currently a professor at Sussex, but is moving to Australia, apparently. Maybe the weather is better there. I don't know what it is. Or maybe their AI regulation is better. I don't know which. So Chris works a lot. He works in AI as well, but he works a lot in net neutrality. And he's got this sort of question about European values and essentially what do we mean by European values. There have been a few issues with ETSI and net neutrality standards, which is what he deals with. Deutsche Telekom, as an example, he doesn't mean them specifically, simply blocks any discussion that affects their business model of premium services. It's the same, not likely to happen for AI. And he points out again, you can see it in the chat, that what Michael Veal, he's saying, was suggesting, is that we get engineers who are discussing kind of engineers' corporate outcomes. He's also adding more things in the chat anyway. And essentially what SSO has become is a kind of coalition of the willing. So is there a danger here that the European values are the European values of the people in the room and not the European values of the people not in the room? And how can we stop that introspection, if you will? I think that's what Chris is meaning. And if I've got you wrong, Chris, I do apologise.
The answer is yes and no. Yes, because as I mentioned earlier, we do see large corporations blocking or at least delaying and obstructing or trying to water down standards. And that happens in any kind of technology. Sometimes the motivation is that a global corporation just doesn't like European standards because it's a lot easier if the whole world is the same from a standardization perspective. And sometimes there are commercial interests against it. So we do see that. However, the European Commission has been wise enough to build a little safeguard into the draft AI Act. And that's sort of a plan B. It doesn't really stand out. I think it's Article 40 or 41 that talks about common specifications. And that what that essentially means is the EU says, well, dear standardization committees, if you can't manage to come up with standards in time for the AI Act taking effect, sort of late 2024, early 25, we are going to write our own standards and make them compulsory. So that's what common specifications means. So if the three ESOs are unable to come up with consensus-based standards, the European Commission will just look around, oh, what's out there, or can we use any of that and elevate it to a status of a harmonized standard, or can we just try and write our own? And then, of course, anything can happen. So my message to obstructive stakeholders is, well, you can't obstruct here, but the risk is that you don't have consensus and the European Commission is going to write their own thing, and then you have no input at all. And that's sort of, that penny has started to drop quite a bit over the past 6 or 9 months.
So if we can crave a little more of your time. We have, unfortunately, one of our fantastic colleagues, Martin Husovec, who is stuck at home. He should have been here tonight, but he's stuck with the deaded positive line on the lateral flow test, which is a shame. So from the comfort of his own home, Martin asks the kind of question I think lots of us are thinking this is a normative question. This is the long one. This is the washing machine one.
Yes.
The technical standards typically specify static requirements for design of products, i.e. how to safely design a washing machine. Can we really use it to regulate the dynamic process of the use of software tools embodying AI? And can that be delegated to standards organizations? We surely wouldn't outsource the decision-making about whether different electricity powered appliances can be used in particular settings to an SDO, e.g. whether a washing machine can be used after 10 p.m. to minimize the noise to neighbors, what we might call ethical use of washing machines. If we expect some guidance at all, then we'd be probably expected from the legislature rather than from a bunch of firms. So a firm challenge from Martin saying, what are you guys doing in this space, kind of thing?
Yeah, that raises lots of really, really good points. Thanks, Martin, for this very fruitful question. Let's put it that way. So, first of all, with regards to the dynamic process, even old technology like a washing machine or a lift or any other piece of machinery degrades over time in use. And hence, we have things like taking our car to be inspected every year or two, because there is an expectation that it'll rust away and it's no longer safe. And so it has to be re-inspected and recertified. And the difference with AI is that we might not be talking about a year, we might be talking about a minute. If it's a self-learning system, it learns something weird and it might just be doing something stupid afterwards. So this means that testing has to be automated, part one, and it also means that there has to be infrastructure for the test results to be, let's put it that way, it has to be impossible to keep the test results secret. So if a company realizes, oh, my AI system has gone out of bounds somehow, it mustn't be possible for them to just keep quiet about it. That infrastructure, the automated tools for automated testing of AI systems and an infrastructure for some kind of notary-like collection of results, that doesn't exist yet. The role of the SDOs is not to set up that infrastructure. The role of the SDOs is just to specify what could such an infrastructure look like. Not even what should it look like, but what could it look like, or what properties does it need to have, and it would then be the job of typically testing houses like the TÜV organizations, like the VDE Testing Institute, like DEKRA, like SGS and others, to come up with implementations of those standards. I'm not sure I completely agree with the statements that we surely wouldn't outsource the decision making about important issues to an SDO. In a way, we do. For something like electrical safety, we do. Whether a washing machine is electrically safe, that's not in regulation, that's all in standards. Whether it survives, as Manny explained earlier, liquid washing detergent kind of spilling over the top and kind of running into the electronic insides of the machine is going to blow up the thing. That is the domain of standards. What is not the domain of standards, and that's where I kind of agree with Martin on what is ethical. So the standard says, this is how you measure the noise of a washing machine, and this is how you measure time. But it doesn't really say whether a particular combination of noise and time is acceptable or not. That really is not the domain of standardization. And it's the same for AI. It doesn't really say, the standard could say this is what is transparency in an AI system. But it doesn't say under which circumstances a certain level of transparency is enough or not enough.
Do you want one more question? Or do we want to, there's still a few people online. People are dropping off online, but that's, we're past the time. We've still got about a dozen people. The question that actually was quite interesting came from a ton of, by the way, Chris Marsden has come back and said, of course, the backup that the commission can write its own common specs also exists in the open internet regulation, of course. So he's backed that back a little bit. That's the thing that was interesting was from an anonymous attendee, because you can send these questions in anonymously. With ratings of transparency and privacy, there might be different persona on the needs of transparency, different users, consumers, data scientists, legislators. How do we deal with all these different personalities? So standard setting is great for something which is standard, but the human use and the human application and the use of AI around humans also, you know, is very non-standard.
Good question again. The discussion on transparency is actually quite broad. So it doesn't just refer to can you somehow see the data that went into training an AI system, or can you somehow see the version of the algorithm? But it also includes criteria such as accessibility. So is this information understandable to a layperson or to an AI expert or to a consumer or to a purchaser or whatever? And it also includes kind of different settings. So should that data only be available in the context of a court case, or in the context of a regulator requesting the data, or should it be available to anyone who asks for it, or should it be automatically published? That is all part of the criteria that fit under the transparency umbrella. We do have a little bit of an issue with the aggregation. I mentioned earlier that it doesn't make sense to aggregate things like the transparency and a privacy rating. But of course, here we aggregate within the transparency rating, and that's still an open question, how much information to make available in terms of drilling down into how that transparency level B came to pass.
We're at the point where we're now 10 minutes over. There are still questions coming in. I was going to say we've answered that one. And Martin, you've had one question, so you don't get another one. There is one that's just come in. I don't know if we want to answer that one or just at this point, if you feel you would like to answer that, and that can be the last question, I think. So it's one answer. You can read that. So for those who can't, if anyone who can't read it, can we end up with de facto AI standards bypassing slow SDOs? There are examples here. What would be the implications? What happens if these guys are too slow?
Yep. Again, very good question. Yes, I agree. There are many historical examples where de facto standards just emerge by the monopoly or near monopoly power of a given company. You could argue that Google TensorFlow or Facebook's PyTorch is standard because lots of people use it, lots of people recognize it, and it's got a very, very broad presence in the market. So it is a de facto standard. As we discussed earlier, the motivation for companies who have a de facto standard established to go along with an STO process is sort of limited, let's put it that way. The thing that protects us, I think, to some extent in the AI world is the existence of the AI Act and the insistence that it's underpinned by standards. So that gives a huge boost to standardization and makes sure that committees like JTC 21 are taken really seriously, both on the part of the Commission, but also on the part of all the standardization stakeholders, many of which do come from kind of monopolists. So, yeah.
And I guess to add to that, related to that, is that there is also industries or sub-industries that self-standardize. So you'll see this in some parts of, you know, aerospace, where they've decided that, you know, cost of failure is too great. So it's in the benefit of everyone to kind of self-standardize. So
Automotive is another example. And that's another kind of tussle inside the standardization world, whether you have horizontal or vertical standards, vertical being industry-specific standards. And for AI, the goal is to make as many standards horizontal as possible, but there will be a few vertical ones, and there will also be a tug of war who gets to do the kind of the intersection between both.
We've dealt with all the questions into this.
So it remains for us in the room and you at home again to thank Manny and Sebastian for not just for the original session, but for your patience and thoroughness, good humor in answering such a wide range of detailed questions. So I'd like the audience please to join me in a final round of applause.